Thank you, Hans and Gülçin. Yeah, well, no problem for the invitation. I was really pleased to come here again and to see that so many of you came to this conference, irrespective of these intrusive measures by different governments. It's now about a short history of the Swiss Constitution. We have several constitutional subjects today. We have almost a Swiss day, I think, today, with Daniel Model in the beginning and my speech, then you about the subject that has to do with Switzerland. So, and here now about the history, a short history. It's a small country, so the history will be short. An official version, so to speak, once you ask what is the history of your constitution, you would hear perhaps it starts with a myth. Back in 1291, 1st of August, you know, our national holiday, that famous oath of Rütli. I'll come to that more in detail. Then we have a phase of the so-called old confederation, where this start of 3 cantons grew up to 13 cantons. Then we have an accident, so to speak. In 1515, there was a battle and a defeat of the Swiss at Marignano. I will come to that. It has a certain role within the history of our constitution. Then we have a long phase, I would say, of overlapping treaties alongside many, many religious and political conflicts. As a, well, that's a constitution of mutual conflict, so to speak. Then we have now, for the first time, a top-down structure implemented by Napoleon, the République Helvétique, according to this liberal quote-unquote, intentions of Napoleon. Then we have a phase, in the meantime, it's 22 cantons, new cantons coming up. This is not a top-down, but it is again a bottom-up structure. In the first phase, they call it restoration. Later on, it's regeneration. We come to that in detail. We have a small civil war. All these national countries had civil wars in the 19th century. So small countries had a small civil war. That's our Sonderbundskrieg. I come to that. Actually, that was, you can compare it with, you know, Italy or the United States. It's a sort of conflict between unionists that won that war and federalists. So as everywhere in that area. And then we have in 1848 I would say the first official constitution of this kind of state. Switzerland is today, and everybody says today this is the birth of the modern, liberal, democratic Switzerland. We are so proud of, I'll come to that later. And since then, there are numerous partial and too general revisions of our constitution without heavy material impact. Even relatively recently, in 1999, Switzerland adopted a completely new constitution, but without material changes. It was just a formal brush up, so to speak. So this is the official row, not too interesting. Now, let's start with this myth. This is more, you know, this wakes you up a little bit after lunch. This beautiful place here, the Rütli, where this oath took place in a summer night, that must have been a night, a light night in a way. If you look at Wikipedia, which is of course a sort of big truth, you know. They say that's the first constituent assembly of continental European, so to speak. So there we had a sort of first constitution adopted by this assembly. But what took really place, according to the myth, and this means according to Friedrich Schiller in this famous novel, William Tell, the big hero of Switzerland, hero for freedom against tyranny. In this novel, he described quite precisely this this Rütli meadow surrounded by high rocks and wooded ground. In the background, the lake is observed, and over it, a moon rainbow. In the early part of the scene, I never saw a moon rainbow, did you? But maybe at that time there was a moon rainbow. The prospect is closed by lofty mountains with glaciers rising behind them. The stage is dark, but the lake and glaciers glisten in the moonlight. So a beautiful scene, huh? According to Schiller. There it is, Rütli, you can go there. It's not just with Schiller, but it's a true place in Switzerland. You can go there. You don't see the glaciers here anymore. Maybe that's because of the climate change in the meantime, you know. But it's there, you can go as a tourist. Now, let's look a bit closer at that happening there. When these people coming together, these three cantons, the representative of three cantons, what did they say, what did they swear, according to Schiller? First, sweary, this is an old-fashioned translation I found somewhere in the internet. Swear we the oath of our confederacy. Now, we shall be unified, a fork of brothers, never to part in danger or in death. They repeat these words with three fingers raised, you see it? So I put it in red because it's a socialist part, you know, unification. Then they said other things too. We swear to put our trust in God Most High and not to quail before the might of man. Okay, this is resistance, that's okay. And then what is really fine, I think, that's why I put it in blue. We swear we will be free as were our fathers and sooner die than live in slavery. All repeat as before and embrace each other. So this is the precise wording of what took place there, according to Schiller. Now there is another actor beside this Rütli community, namely the hero of the novel, you know. There I can introduce him, William Tell, with his son. He actually is not a politician. He does not take place at the Rütli. He is not the debater, he is the actor. He acts. He doesn't talk very much, he acts. He's a hunter by profession, that's why his crossbow. He shoots not on tyrants, except sometimes, but on animals, on deer, on birds as a hunter. And he is occupied with his family, himself, his house, and that's why this is a famous wording in Switzerland. This novel is quite well known. Die Axt im Haus erspart den Zimmermann. This says that, and so he works at home, he repairs some door, and then he says, and so methinks the door will hold a while, the axe at home off safe and saves the carpenter. He has not to hire other people. He makes what he has to do himself. That's William Tell. And now the evil part, the third part, this is Hermann Gessler. This is the incorporation, the symbol of wickedness. For instance, he says, and he is the representative. So say what you please, I'm the emperor's servant, and my first care must be to do his pleasure. So he represents some higher concentrated big power here down on this world at this place. He is the personified brutality in this novel. For instance, in a very well-known scene too, he says to tell this. "You shall shoot an apple from your boy's head. I do desire and command it so." He was offended, Hermann Gessler, that Till did not, you know, incline before him, and that's why he said, "You're a good hunter, I was said, so now I will check whether that's true. You will shoot an apple from the head of your boy." And Till said, "Oh no, please not," and that all around standings were shocked by that, but he insisted. The story went well. He hit the apple and not the head of his son, and he took revenge after that. I will come to that too. So this is the evil, bad, wicked Gessler. So our constitutional players, one could say, we have this assembly, we have Till, and we have Gessler. And for the interface, so to speak, you have this aggressive oppression by Gessler, you have resistance, the collective resistance from the whole group, and you have the individual defense from Till. What is interesting, by the way, and I will come to that later, what is the relation, the internal relation, so to speak, between this group and the individual? So is that perhaps also a sort of aggression within the small internal relationship, an aggression towards the individual, and as a consequence, a defense, a reaction against this whole group? So these are these constitutional players, and now what happens? Of course, collective defense, there nothing happens. They discuss on the Rütli. But the individual defense, there something happens. After that scene I mentioned before with the apple and the boy and so on, some scenes later, this happened. I will show it to you a bit closer. Here you see, according to this Act 4, Scene 3 of the novel, Till shot Gessler dead. He took revenge for this humiliation, for this brutality. And the last word Gessler says, cries out, according to Schiller, "That shot was Till's." And that was the starting shot for the whole revolution then. Then, after that, those politicians, you know, from the Rütli, they started then their revolution. But that was the starting shot. Without the individual resistance, that collective resistance would not have taken place. I like that picture very much and the connection of it. But now let's go closer to the constitution. Now we have this three parts, we know in the meantime. The red one, "We shall be unified, a fork of brothers." If you translate it into constitutional terms, you think about statist collectivism. And even you think about concentration of power. So even this enemy, in a way, is included in this red line, collectivist part of that constitution. On the other side, and this, there you have a top-down approach. On the other side, or on the bottom side, you wouldn't say statist collectivism. You would, in constitutional terms, or in international terms perhaps, you would say this is rather a non-aggression treaty between these people. Not even mainly against a third, but within. We promise to each other that we won't attack each other. And historically, this was what happened in that time. The other one, the red part, here of course you have this bottom-up approach, and this middle part, which is perhaps you could call it a defense alliance, that is not historical. Historical is just this bottom part of, in principle, mutually not attacking each other, of course, with some aspects also to this third power, this Habsburgian power. So we have these elements that mainly the difference between that top-down aspect and the bottom-up aspect. Now, out of this myth, of course, it's a sophisticated myth, according to Schiller, we have sort of contradicting constitutional principles. We have on the top side this united collectivity, unified general goals. You have monopolized power. They all together form a power. And you could call it an archist structure. This is a notion not often used, but sometimes it's used, and it means a structure with archy, arche, Greek, archy, with a monopolized top instance. This is an archist structure. We have this on the one side, and there you have this top-down approach, and on the other side, on the bottom side, you have the contrary. You have separated individuality, incorporated in William Tell. You have a variety of many personal goals. You have decentralized powers, and you have, as a consequence, an anarchist structure, which is essentially a bottom-up structure. And now to put it more, conventionally into the content of a constitution, how we know constitutions. We have in the constitution, in the Swiss constitution, in the American constitution, in German constitution, all these well-known constitutions of national states, you have these items. You have under archist goals or structures, there is, these goals of security as a state function, ecology, energy, education, culture, sport, infrastructure, communication, all as they say, function that the state must supply to society, then good things, prevention of poverty. And what is interesting in this connection, you have here branches of government, which is, or the aspect of branches of government, which is a treacherous expression, three branches of one tree, You do not have three trees, you have one tree with three branches, so all belongs to the same. So what is intended, division of power, is the opposite is true. It's a concentration of power, three branches in one tree. So these are the typical red aspects, archist aspects. And now, on the bottom side, you have anarchist elements that are also in these conventional constitutions. The fundamental rights, such as life, limb, and liberty, so the classical liberal rights, freedom rights, negative rights, property rights, free speech, and so on. The rule of law, that statist activities or state activities must be governed by law, which is simply not the case, because as you know, it's the state itself who defines the laws, and he privileges himself all the time. So there should be a rule of law in this constitution, or it's written in these constitutions, but it's not a fact. Separation of power, there is no separation of power, there is concentration of power. And accordingly, you have this top-down aggressiveness, as we currently know very, very strongly. And you, on the other side, you have this bottom-up defensiveness. Now, again, to go back on the historical context, now on the time beam, let's start again with this 1291 myth. And then one could say in Switzerland we have an anarchist tradition. In this sense, I developed now in the sense of this blue part here. We have first this old confederation, which, as I told, was not much more than a non-aggression treaty, with growing numbers of cantons. And afterwards we had this permanent conflicts phase. In the beginning, that was rather religious conflicts between Catholics and Protestants, and in other places too. And later on, more political conflicts between conservatives and liberals. And one very prominent conflict was that small war I mentioned before, this Sonderbundskrieg that took place in 1847. One could say until then we had this anarchist tradition of the Swiss constitution. There were some exceptions. In 1515, I mentioned it briefly in the beginning, there was an attempt by this confederation to become a global player, to become a military force, to incorporate the Duchy of Milano. But the French king did not agree with that, and he was quite stronger than the Swiss, and defeated them at the Battle of Marignano in northern Italy heavily. That was a big defeat, but good businessmen as they were, they entered then into a long-time contract with the French king to supply mercenaries and to get money. That was a long-time good cooperation. One could say that was an anarchist error besides this anarchist tradition. But then came anarchist elements. First, I already mentioned Napoleon in 1798 with his République Helvétique. Then again, one phase, a blue one, that went back to a decentralized structure, just a treaty between, in the meantime, 22 cantons. This is the phase we will hear something about in the next speech, I think, from Hans. Then we have this, I mentioned already, this famous constitution of 1848, which was contrary to international law because it was forced to the minority by a majority, even though, according to international law, unanimity would have been required. So this is typical top-down, you know, anarchist structure. Then that's a later amendment of the constitution where the vote, the public vote, the people's vote, not only on elections, was introduced. Then the codification of civil law. I added that after the speech of this morning of Stefan Kinsella when he talked about what is the law, constitution of law. Not now to explain it in detail, but it's typical that around 1900 in Switzerland, there was a first unified civil code. Not the constitution, but the civil code, but in close connection with this unification and top-down developments. And since then, just formal update, as I told you, until now. So one could say, and this is so the overall picture, after this anarchist tradition, until the 19th century, we have a clearly anarchist development, like a bit everywhere. Or one could say, out of Gessler became Napoleon, and out of Napoleon became our today's federal state. So this is an epigone of Gessler, if you want. That's not the official version of the history of Swiss constitution. Now, what is then the content now of this constitution today? If you look at the today formally being in force, you see these elements we just met before, these anarchist goals, and on the other side, this anarchist element. But if you look at it closer, then you see that the aggressiveness of the red part is becoming more and more and stronger, and to say it a little bit simplified, the blue part is crossed out. If you have now discussions about, you know, reducing fundamental rights, personal freedom, freedom of business by these corona measures, you lose almost always in Switzerland. So I think this is unfortunately a bit the situation we have today. Now, to look back again, why did it come that after such a long blue tradition, anarchist tradition, things like that, that heavily anarchist structures came into, you know, political life of Switzerland? I look back, very much back. I broaden the view to 10,000 before Christ. And here too, I think you see a long development underlying the anarchist tradition we have in Switzerland, of course in other places also, maybe in Switzerland more than in other places, but this is not just, you know, this did not just start in 1291, but that's the result of a really long development. And I think you can really go back, I'm not a specialist for that, but I'm quite convinced if you look at anthropological or sociological theories and studies, then you see that you can say, at least since this Neolithic revolution, you have concrete structures where you can say these are decentralized structures, diversity, you can say anarchist structures. If you go all through that, you know that there is agriculture coming up in that area, also physical change, lactose tolerance, then settlements, you have family structures, small tribes, local princes, federalist structures, and so on, until, I would say in Switzerland, until 1848. So this is a long tradition, but why and where does this red line come from? And there too, of course, you have a certain tradition, not that long, but you have some. So if you see these national states were predecessed, more before those were absolutist states. We had earlier the Roman Empire, we had a good presentation about yesterday. But where did those power, these big power concentrations come from? And I think what is interesting, they come from an event not too far away. It's just 5,000 years old. That's quite recent. Huh? That's yesterday, if you look at it in a broad view. Yesterday, big cities arising, namely in Mesopotamia, Uk, Uruk, Nineveh, later Babylon, later the Egypts. So this was a new phenomenon. This came not out of a long tradition. So I try to picture it like that. I think out of this sedentariness connection, you know, a certain accumulation of many people at the same relatively small place and so on. So that gave rise to these new and very impressive power concentrations. So that was a new development. So one could say the long-term development or evolution is on the blue side. It's an individual one, while this red top-down, aggressive, power-concentrated aspect is a relatively new development. You can even look further back. This is beyond, you know, philosophy or history. It's just, I would say, pure natural science. 7 million years back, lengthily before Homo sapiens, you see at the right side, Homo sapiens, I put there, maybe he will become even more sapiens than he is today, somewhere tomorrow, which says in 100,000 years or so. Homo sapiens, as such, he is, I think the time frame given to him is around minus 500,000. Language coming much later, about 100,000, but this is about like us, in a way. But there are pre-ancestors going much back, Homo erectus, which was an important thing to stand on two legs instead of four legs, to look around, to judge the situation. And I think what is interesting, back to early hominids, to primatomorphs, so species lengthily before us that were sort of ancestors of later hominids, and these kind of species, until then the Homo sapiens, what is typical for all them, their big abilities, their big skills, their special skills that gave them advantages over much stronger other animals, was individual self-consciousness, was self-responsibility, was self-competence. Each is competent for himself, which does not exclude to cooperate in a group of hunters, for instance, not exclude at all, but any combination, any group is based on each member's decision or more or less conscious will. And I would say, and this is not ideological, but just as a natural fact, that this is maybe the most prominent aspect in the whole behavioral revolution of man. Of course, I said the title, A Long History of Trial and Error. You know, evolution is not according to a plan, to a goal. It goes as it goes. And maybe there are developments that are not successful, that they do not prove useful in real life. So there are, beside successes, there are errors, one there, always errors, but they have vanished, they have disappeared, because that's the essence of being an error. It didn't prove useful, so it disappeared. Here one, there one, here one. And now there's an interesting small error happening just recently, about 5,000 years ago. It's not a small error. Errors go by, let's hope. And if you have these 7 million, you know, this broad view, you even have to take the magnifying glass to look at. And what was this error that took place recently? It was the state. The state is an error of the evolution of human behavior. I think this is maybe the most accurate description of this phenomenon, this strange phenomenon of these accumulations of power, that you know, that they contain an attitude that some organs of this organization are competent for all individuals. This is an error of evolution, and I'm quite convinced that this error will go by. if I'm optimist, it will go by while humans remain alive. Which says that they follow libertarian ideas, for instance, and you know, realize that was an error, okay? You can make error, but you can become wiser, and that's why we leave that alone and go on the blue line instead of the red one. If I would be pessimist, which is not the case, then it will also disappear, but along with the species. That's not excluded, I would say. Once you see these developments to the world state, then I could imagine such scenarios, which makes it even more useful to work on the blue line. Now, to sum up or to come to a conclusion, again, in Switzerland again, huh? Very, very small, and you can overview it. We have this constitution, we saw this high aggressiveness right now especially, and we have seen that the blue part is away. This is, as I said before, showed before, this is our today's constitution. Now, actually, the medicine is quite simple. We have to change the crossing out. We have to do this. That would be the constitution on the blue line, a constitution that omits all these red things. We do not need them because, as you see, out of this very long evolutionary tradition, all what functions in human societies is what is ultimately based with the individual. So the bottom-up approach, the defensive approach against power structures. And all what is then, let's say, in a level above the individual's general social aspects, they too will be influenced bottom-up. There will be no program or goals or anything over individual goals on that level. There will be an outcome of many, many individual decisions, corporations, always based with the individuals bottom up, and that of course will have an outcome also in higher spheres of society. I think that would be the approach. So, if this is true, so we know the solution, so we know it, oh, let's do it. But it's not that easy to defend this blue part, to realize this essential aspect, this defensiveness of this blue part. I'm not sure what I should do. I just know that William Tell would know what to do. So, thank you for your attention.